I had my partner removed from my house by police after his third physical attack, but the first in which my baby was in my arms. I naively thought the abuse would end that night, but it only escalated. Since the separation, my child's father has broken my front door when I refused to let him back into my house, has threatened suicide by cop if I call for help, has threatened to have both of my kids put into the system by making false reports to child services, and has attempted to drug me with a sedative at a coffee shop knowing I would be driving home with our infant in the back seat. I've disclosed the abuse to therapists, police, my friends, and family. I have completed a danger assessment with a trained domestic violence worker and scored the highest level of risk, extreme danger. The questionnaire stated that I was in need of urgent safety measures. He tells me every time we speak that he has nothing left to lose, nothing to live for, and that he holds me entirely responsible for his dismal circumstances. He drinks. He is chronically unemployed. I have been certain at times that he was preparing to kill me, my children, and himself. So I sought a protective order, and the order was denied because the judge felt my fears were based on nothing but, quote, suspicions and opinions about this man's personality. I think the trauma of being ignored and left unprotected has actually been one of my greatest in this entire ordeal. I have learned to feel unsafe around him, but I was just beginning to feel empowered and believed by the professionals supporting me. I was not prepared for the crushing hopelessness that would result from the hearing, from exposing my most painful truths and fears just to be dismissed as paranoid and sent a fact sheet. I don't know how I am supposed to serve this man with court papers seeking custody and supervision for his parenting time when I know I may not survive that day, yet I have very little choice as I need to protect my child from his violence. My own outreach worker told me she felt my best course of action would be to flee, to move far away and never look back. I am a college professor with a home that I own, a promising career ahead of me, and an older child in school with friends and activities they adore. I will not be surrendering that good life I built for myself and my children to this man. All I can do is hope that he doesn't choose to end it, as I take back the control he seized from me in what should have been the most beautiful season of our lives. Hi, I'm Zahn Vilines, a writer and feminist activist, and this is the Liberating Motherhood Podcast. Today, I am here with Dr. Emma Katz. Hi, Dr. Katz.
Hi.
And I'm so excited to talk to her today because she's going to speak to so many of the issues that I talk about. Dr. Emma Katz is a researcher in domestic violence and coercive control, whose work has helped shape legislation and professional practice globally. Her book, Coercive Control in Children's and Mothers' Lives, is widely acclaimed. Emma also brings her research to the public in an accessible and influential way on her Substack, Decoding Coercive Control with Dr. Emma Katz, which is read by thousands of people in more than 90 countries across the world. You can read it at dremmakatz.substack.com. Emma's research has illuminated children's experiences of coercive control, which had previously remained largely invisible. She argues that children are affected by many forms of abuse inherent to coercive control, including the breaking down of close relationships with loved ones, deprivation of resources, constrained behavior, and isolation from the outside world. Her research has been described as pioneering work that will change how we understand and respond to children's experience of domestic abuse. And I'm just so grateful to have her here today because I think one of the most common things we hear in activism is, well, he's a shitty husband, but he's actually a really good dad. And I think that Dr. Katz's work shows that to abuse a child's mother is to abuse a child. So I'm so glad to have you today. And we're going to get started with the basics. What is coercive control?
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be able to share my insights with you and with your listeners. Oh, that vignette at the beginning, my heart was breaking for that mum. It's appalling. And when she said that the worst thing was being one of the worst things was the way that the court disbelieved her. There's a term for that. It's called institutional betrayal. And it is really traumatizing. And that's well recognized within researchers who look into this sort of vile kind of trauma. So you asked, what is coercive control? So I'll give it you in a nutshell, and then I'll go into a little bit more detail. In a nutshell, Coercive control involves situations where somebody subjects another person to persistent and wide-ranging controlling behavior over a long period of time, taking away their freedom and autonomy, and they make it clear that standing up for themselves will be punished. So very much a do what I say or else situation. So that's the nutshell. To go into a bit more detail, the punishment for not doing what the perpetrator wants can take many different forms. It might be violence, it might be beating you up, but it might not be that. But it will definitely be something that the abuser knows that the victim and survivor dreads and will go a long way to avoid. Things like hurting loved ones, coercing the victim survivor into sexual activity that they don't want to be doing, economically abusing them, so perhaps taking their money or dragging them through court post-separation to drain their money, or as in the story you told at the beginning, it might be making these threats to kill, making it very clear that the perpetrator is willing to go to the point of death, and thereby keeping the victim survivor in a state of terror with those threats. So perpetrators, by repeatedly punishing a victim survivor for non-compliance, what the perpetrator wants, what they intend, is to demoralize and terrorize the victim survivor into a state of permanent subjugation, permanent kind of servitude, terror, turning them into a kind of puppet on a string-like figure who the perpetrator can get whatever they want from. And the perpetrator is motivated by their deeply held and really harmful belief that they are entitled to control others in a way that strips them of their normal rights and liberties, and not just any others, but usually their girlfriend, their wife, their children. And they're motivated by this deeply held and harmful drive that they have to get control over the people in their family and maintain that control for as long as they want it. So perpetrators, they want their victims, their targets' lives to be all under their control. But at the same time, the perpetrator wants a lot of freedom for themselves. So they'll impose 1,000 rules on their partner or their child, but they won't stick to any rules themselves. So there's a great imbalance there. And I also want to say that coercive control can often be mistaken for a lot of different things, but it's not about love. People aren't behaving this way because they're madly in love. It's not about lost tempers, because perpetrators can control their temper when it suits them. It's not about anger problems, because again, the perpetrator can control their anger when it suits them. And it's not about drug or alcohol misuse, although that might be going on in the situation, but it's not what's causing the abusive behavior. It might make it worse, but it's not the root cause. Like I say, the real root cause is that perpetrators believe they're entitled to do this and they're highly motivated to do it. They want to exploit their target and get control of their life. And this intersects so well with what you so brilliantly talk about in Liberating Motherhood, the unequal division of labor in the home. One thing that perpetrators of coercive control want is to be able to exploit the domestic labor of their partner, and I'm putting partner in inverted quote marks because it's not a partnership, it's like a sustained, prolonged assault. So one of the things that they want, one of the many things they want, is to exploit domestic labour by putting the partner in a situation where they're scared to not do all the domestic labour because the perpetrator will have such a negative reaction if they don't. But it also goes much wider than that as well.
That's a lot. That's really helpful. One thing that I really appreciate you saying is that this isn't happening because of an anger management problem. It's not happening because of passion. It's not happening because of all of these reasons that we use to dismiss it. And I found in my own work that we seem to have this idea that if there's a reason that it is happening, that then we have to work on the reason it's happening rather than the actual behavior. So if he is an alcoholic, for example, well, we need to get him to alcohol treatment rather than addressing the fact that this is someone who's abusing someone when they're drinking. So I really appreciate you addressing that. But I'm also hoping you can speak a little more to why these causes are not the real cause and what you think the root cause is of these men who feel compelled to control others. Why is this so widespread and perhaps even normal in heterosexual relationships?
That's a really good question. I don't have all the answers to that because I feel like I would need to have five more PhDs than I actually do to really have a handle on that why. It's a huge question. But I think one thing I can say is that we see a lot more men perpetrating coercive control than women do. There are women coercive control perpetrators out there, but they're much rarer and they're much more likely to go so far as to kill their partners. That's far less likely in the case with a woman perpetrator. And killing is the ultimate act of control for these perpetrators. It's not a loss of control. It's not that they snapped. It's the ultimate act of control for them. So one of the reasons why we see this imbalance where it's the vast majority of coercive control perpetrators are men, I think, is because of the level of entitlement that our society gives to men to behave in these ways. And the fact that it's pretty normalized for men to have a certain level of control and power over their family. So the idea that a man is the head of the household, for a lot of people, that is still the way they think. And even if they don't think that now, it was only a couple of generations ago that would have been the way things were thought about in their family. And we see male power and control really normalized in our culture to a far greater extent than female power and control is. Where women have power and control, it makes people uncomfortable. It's seen as a problem. People often really, really struggle with that, whether it's a female politician or a boss or a wife who's perhaps earning more than her husband. So I think our cultures have really set up the situation where we're going to see a lot of men taking this power and control that they've been told is rightfully theirs and taking it to quite an extreme place. So for some men, they'll take their ideas about entitlement to a certain extent and they'll be really bad husbands because of that. But for some, they'll take it to such an extreme place that they become a full-blown coercive control perpetrator. And they're really at like the extreme end of the spectrum of controlling behavior and of absolutely, being the most terrible, terrible person to be in a relationship with. And again, I use this relationship in inverted commas because it's not even a relationship, but it was disguised as that at the beginning. I would say that's one major element of why male perpetrators are so much more common than female perpetrators. But as to the rest of it, why some men and not others, I think that everyone has a kind of unique set of circumstances and people respond to the messages they get from their cultures to different extents. And some people reject the messages they get from their cultures while others fully embrace them. So for example, a vegan in a meat eating culture is rejecting the messages that they got about meat eating. And similarly, a man who's actively anti-sexist in a sexist culture is rejecting a lot of messages that he's getting from his culture. So why some men go down that route and others don't, I'm not too sure, but one thing I do feel is that it's not particularly helpful to put mental health labels on coercive controllers. So a lot of people are very drawn to explaining a man's behavior as narcissism or sociopathy or psychopathy, to say he's a narcissist, he's a sociopath, he's a psychopath. And I can totally see why people find those labels helpful, but at the same time, I think it distracts, as you just said, from looking at the behavior. And I think if we just look at the behavior of what they're doing, that tells us more than enough that they're a despicable and dangerous person, without worrying about what you know, what particular label might apply to them. And also coercive control perpetrators are very, very predictable in their own right. It's like they've all read a very similar script. It's quite, you know, the way that they're going to escalate when they receive pushback is quite predictable. So, yeah, again, I don't think we need a kind of label like narcissism to help us predict what they're going to do. I think we can do that very easily by looking at their behavior more directly.
That's so interesting that you talk about them having a script, because one of the most consistent pieces of feedback that I get from readers is that they thought it was just them. And they didn't know that so many women's partners were using this exact same language. And, you know, women will email me questions and I can almost predict like what their husbands are going to say next based on what they're telling me. And the thing that I often tell women is it's like this patriarchal, destructive, oppressive society has turned a lot of men into like not fully human people. They're just repeating these awful things that they've been taught without even questioning them. But you said something really interesting that I want to go back to that I've never heard anybody say before, and now I'm going to latch onto it forever, which is that this is not really a relationship in the typical way. And I think that the way that most people conceive of this is that you have a relationship and the abuse is layered on top. But I think you're right that in these dynamics, the abuse is integral to the dynamic and not separable from the relationship. So could you just speak a little more to that? Because I know so many women who think that they can like cure their partners, or who think that they have a good relationship under the abuse, but I think maybe they don't have a relationship at all under the abuse.
I think that is, I'm really glad you brought me back to that, because I think that's such an important point. So yeah, so I see this all the time as well. For example, people will say the first time the abuse happened was the day they got married, or the first time the abuse happened was when she was pregnant. And I want to just like say I'm usually reading this in a newspaper piece or a magazine piece about domestic abuse, and I want to just say, whoa, are you really sure about that? Because what you probably mean is that was the first time where he did something that was so explicitly, obviously abusive that the victim felt confident in saying that was an incident of abuse. Usually we're talking about that he hit her on that occasion, because that's often the thing that people wait for until before they're willing to say this is abuse. But actually, the first thing that perpetrators do is they hook you into a relationship with them fast, and really suck you in really hard, because they know that they want to start controlling you. So they need to get you on board quickly, and they need to get you on board very thoroughly so that they can start doing what they really want to do, which is controlling you. And so at the beginning, they're presenting as your dream come true, your prince charming, exactly what you needed at that moment in your life. And so many victim survivors say this. They say it was so great at the beginning. It was a whirlwind. He seemed like everything that I was looking for. And he was doing that on purpose right from the start. So that manipulation right at the beginning, from the first text messages, from the first date, that was the beginning of the abuse, not the first time that he hit you or was sexually coercive with you or called you a really vile, horrible name. And yeah, I think that what these kinds of men want to do is to get you to think that they're in a relationship, get you to think that you're going to have a good future with them, get you heavily invested. And often this is on a very accelerated time scale. So, you know, they pursue you quite relentlessly. They sweep you off your feet. They'll have you pregnant and married to them much quicker than you would have perhaps done on your own timetable if they hadn't been rushing you. Or they'll move you in with them or move into your place quite quickly. And once they've got you sufficiently on board, thinking that this is the relationship, this is the love of your life, and once they've got you sufficiently entrapped because you're tied to them financially through living together or legally through marriage or, you know, through having a pregnancy with them, a child with them, then they'll feel a lot freer to start introducing the control. And For the victim survivor, yeah, it seems like this has come out of nowhere, and it seems like this is not what the relationship is really like, because it just starts to creep in and it's not seemed to be like that before. But I'm afraid it was like that all along with the coercive controller. And we'll often find also that this wasn't the first time they'd coercively controlled someone, and they have a long history of exes who they've done this to in one form or another. So yeah, I think if we look at it that way, and we look at it as this sort of sustained manipulation and this sustained entrapment that the perpetrator worked on for months and years, it can change our perspective on it. And I know it can be totally heartbreaking for a victim survivor to think about it that way, but also in some ways quite liberating, because it never was this good thing. So they haven't lost this good thing, because it never was that in the first place. But that brings with it so many different emotions. I'm really aware of that. But I do think it's important to be able to recognize the reality of what actually happened, definitely.
Yeah, the heartbreak is really resonant. I had a woman to me, who I was talking to yesterday, say, well, how do you know that he doesn't love me? How do you know that he never loved me? And I think that that's something that a lot of women really get stuck on, is that they had this image of this beautiful, loving relationship, and it turns out that that was never real. And we culturally teach women to derive so much of their value from their relationships that then they conclude that, you know, well, they have no value if this man didn't love them. My perspective.
And I just want to say to anyone who feels that you have so much worth just for being a human being, and you are so worthy of love. And if this person who turned out to be, excuse my language, a total arsehole didn't love you, that does not mean that you were not worthy of love and that you're not still worthy of love. I just want to put that into the conversation, just for anyone who would benefit from hearing that right now.
Yes. Well, and the other thing is that our culture has broken so many men in such a way that they are not capable of loving women. And I think that we have to accept that probably most women are going to have to be single or willing to be single to be healthy, because there aren't enough healthy men. And I think coming to terms with that can maybe be helpful, coming to terms with the reality that, you know, there are other ways to get love from, you know, family, from friends, all of that.
Yes.
You know,
and from pets as well.
Yeah,
pets are a wonderful source of love.
You can become a cat lady, and that's lovely.
Or a dog lady.
Or a dog
pig,
lady.
Rabbit.
I'm a frog lady. I have like 19 frogs. It's total.
Oh wow.
Yeah. I think the last number I gave my husband was that there were only 14 in the house. So maybe we'll just say there are only 14. We've gotten 5 more that he didn't notice.
Well, that's really cool. I've never met anyone who had 19 frogs or anything like that before.
They're, cool. Yeah, they're really cool. I make these little like bioactive enclosures for them, and they chirp and they do little froggy things. They're just charming little pets, and they don't you know, they don't need anything, which I like. So you know, you talked a lot about how a lot of people conceive of abuse as only physical, and I think that that's really critical. We think that it's fine as long as he's not hitting her. And something that I'm seeing more and more is this discourse around red flags, you know, looking for red flags. And I think that can be helpful. But what I'm finding more and more is that a lot of the behaviors that people put on lists of red flags are not red flags. They're abusive behaviors. And it's just, it's got me really thinking about how we have so heavily socialized women to accept so many layers of abuse that we don't recognize abuse when it's happening to us until it has accelerated to a really intense point. So I'm hoping you could speak a little bit to why abuse matters, even if it's not physical, and also what kind of behaviors constitute abuse. I know that that can be tricky because, you know, we've all yelled at someone we love, and one-time yelling is not necessarily abuse. But I think just generally telling people what to look for could be helpful.
Absolutely. I think that it becomes abuse when somebody is behaving in a way that is controlling and is taking away your choices and your freedom and treating your feelings and your needs as though they don't matter in a sustained way, you know, not just one incident of insensitivity in a sea of otherwise good behavior, but there's a pattern here. And also then making it so confronting them and holding them accountable safely is impossible. And I think that's where we kind of take where bad behavior turns into abusive behavior, where you can't confront the person safely because they're going to have such a negative reaction that it makes it just you just feel like it's not worth trying to bring it up with them, because you know from past experience that they're going to have such a negative reaction that it's not worth it. And that negative reaction could be that they get violent with you, or it could be that they get nasty with your children as retaliation, or it could be that they spend your money or spend their own money frivolously, recklessly, leaving the family in a really tight squeeze that month. They can't pay the rent or something because he's retaliated by gambling away the rent money, for example, or spending it on some expensive computer or something. It could be sexual coercion, you know, that you know that if you say no to whatever he wants to do sexually, that he's going to take it out on you by doing something even worse or doing it more violently. Or again, that he's going to hurt the kids in some way if you're not complying. And so it's situations of coercive control are situations where the victim doesn't have genuine autonomy and choices, because they've ended up having to filter everything that they're doing through this lens of how's he going to react to that? Is that going to make him happy? Is that going to make him angry? Is he going to be aware that I've done this and backlash against me for it? Can I perhaps get away with doing it without him noticing? And so you started to tiptoe around in your own life. You know, we call it walking on eggshells, but for some victims and survivors, it's more like tiptoeing around a load of landmines rather than eggshells, because the explosion when it goes off is so bad. So there's a lot of perpetrators out there who don't use physical violence because they're smart and they realise that using physical violence gives the game away. It's something that our culture frowns upon more than it frowns upon other kinds of abuse. It's something that the perpetrator is more likely to get into trouble about than any other kind of abuse. Not that they're particularly likely to get into much trouble anyway, because our, you know, police and justice response to perpetrators is so pathetic most of the time, or a lot of the time. But they know that if they're going to get caught and punished for anything, it's going to be physical violence. And also that is the one thing that some victims and survivors, you know, that might alert them to the fact that this is abusive, and it might tip them over the edge from thinking this is a bad marriage into thinking this is an abusive marriage. So they'll deliberately not use physical violence so that you don't reach that tipping point, so that they can keep you captured and keep exploiting you and dominating and controlling you for longer and longer and longer. But perpetrators, you know, they aren't geniuses, and sometimes they miscalculate and they use a tactic in a way that does backfire on them, because the victim survivor does start to really think this is, you know, this is unbearable, and I'm going to start to look for a way out. So yeah, I think that the use of violence is really complicated, but most perpetrators will only use it when they think it's necessary. So often they will use it if they feel like their non-violent means of controlling you are starting to not work, and then it will escalate into physical violence to try and scare you back into compliance. On the other hand, some perpetrators use physical violence really early and really frequently because they calculate that they've got the victim survivor sufficiently entrapped that they can get away with doing that. And you know, that might be a victim survivor who, for whatever reason, is really going to struggle to leave them, perhaps financially, perhaps for religious and cultural reasons. So they feel like they've got enough of an advantage that they can use that physical violence really early and frequently. So it's very calculated, it's very strategic on the behalf on the part of perpetrators. It's strategic, it's functional. They're really making decisions as smartly as they know how, and the smarter they are, the better they'll be at that. And you do end up with a lot of perpetrators who don't use physical violence at all, but find many, many, many other ways to absolutely abuse and control and decimate the life of the person who they say that they love.
So one thing I want to talk about with identifying abuse is one thing that we have all seen is that sooner or later, the dominant group, whether that's men, whether that's white people, whether that's wealthy people, will co-opt the language of social justice. So I live in the deep south of the United States, and one thing we see constantly is white people claiming that they're a victim of reverse racism. And I also see men insisting that actually they're the abuse victim when their partners do very normal things like imposing boundaries or saying no to sex or asserting their needs. And I think that in these controlling dynamics, because they become kind of a cult of one, it becomes very easy for women to believe that maybe they are the abusive one. You know, they'll Google a checklist of abusive behaviors and they'll see one thing that they did one time on that list. Can you speak to how abusers often make their victims feel like they're the bad guys, like they deserve it, like they've caused it, and how that dynamic works, and also what victim survivors might do to assess whether they're really the abusive one or whether they're just being manipulated?
I think that this is a really common issue, as you say. So perpetrators are excellent at getting victims and survivors to think that everything is their fault. So they structure whole arguments and confrontations around getting the victim survivor to think that. So, for example, the victim survivor wants to do something very normal and very reasonable and go and see their friend. And the perpetrator says, you know, how could you want to see your friend? I need you. I'm having a crisis. My life's really bad at the moment. I need you here. You're so selfish and horrible and mean to me for wanting to go and see your friend. Or they might get really sulky and quiet and express their displeasure that way. Or they might say, you know, if you go out tonight, I'm going to think that you don't love me. You're proving that you don't love me because you're not prioritizing me. And the victim doesn't, you know, they don't realize that the perpetrator is an abuser. They still think that this is someone who they love and who loves them. So they're like, oh my gosh, I've made my partner feel this way. I must be communicating something really badly to him to make him feel that I don't love him enough. This must be my fault that I'm, you know, that I've created a situation where he doesn't realize how much I love him. And so she'll take responsibility, she'll back down, she'll not go and see the friend. But the whole point of that tactic was that perpetrators need victims and survivors isolated because it makes them easier to control. Because if you have people who you can check in with regularly, who love you and support you, you're getting an outside perspective on it, which is totally undermining the perpetrator's ability to manipulate you. So the outside perspectives need to be cut off as much as the perpetrator can manage to orchestrate that. But they've set the whole thing up in such a way that the victim survivor walks away from that thinking it's their fault. They didn't communicate how much they loved the perpetrator. They were being selfish for wanting to abandon them in their hour of need for whatever pretext that, you know, the perpetrator makes. So the perpetrator does just set everything up to make the victim survivor feel that way. And also, again, we're living in a society where women are told from very, very early on in their lives that relationships take work. Women are the more mature ones, the more emotionally intelligent ones. They're the ones who've got to do this work of making the relationship work because men are too incompetent and unable to express themselves. You know, bless them, we need to look after them, given this kind of horrible narrative around it, which obviously I'm deeply critical of. So So when an abuse perpetrator starts to draw on that narrative, it's very, very easy for the woman to fall into thinking this is a relationships take work issue. I'm going to make the concession, make the sacrifice, use my emotional intelligence to try and make him feel more loved, give him what he wants so he'll feel happier. That will make the relationship work. So society and the perpetrator are working hand in hand to get the woman thinking that way. It'd be so much harder for a woman to get a man thinking that way, to get him thinking it's all his fault, that he needs to make all these sacrifices, that he needs to do all that work, because that's not the narrative that men have grown up with. So it'd be so much more of a tough ask for a female perpetrator, which is why we don't see very many women attempting this, amongst other reasons, but that's definitely part of it. It's just awful for the victim survivor, because they spend years thinking it's all their fault. And even after they've separated from the abuser, separation doesn't mean that you suddenly understand everything that went on. People tend to separate because they get to a point where staying together is in some way intolerable, and separation becomes an urgent necessity. But that doesn't mean that they've necessarily figured out all the ways the abuser was manipulating their thinking. So even after they perhaps divorced the guy 5 years, they might still feel that they were in part responsible and that it was kind of their fault. These things can sit with women for such a long time, and it's totally unfair. I think we need to really hold in our minds what is reasonable and what is unreasonable. And, you know, it is reasonable for a woman to say no. And it's reasonable for her to go and see her friends. And it's reasonable for her to wear what she wants to wear and to look the way she wants to look. That's an important part of any human being's identity. And it's not reasonable of a man to try and control how she looks, control who she sees, to monopolize all of her time and her effort and her energy. As you say really brilliantly in your work, it's stealing her life, and that's not fair. So, yeah, I think that perpetrators will really try and twist what is fair and unfair. But I think women need to hold in their minds quite strongly their understanding of what is fair and unfair, because it will help them to reject people's attempts to, as you say, turn this all around and make them seem like the unreasonable one. And also there's a term for this where perpetrators say that they're the victims. It's a term your listeners might have heard of. It's called DARVO, DARVO. So that's a tactic that perpetrators really commonly use. And the D is for deny. The perpetrator denies that they were abusive. And then the A is for attack. They attack the credibility of the victim survivor, the memories of, you know, that she has. You know, they tell her that what happened didn't happen, or that she's remembering it wrong. And then they reverse victim and offender, the RVO. So they say, you were the perpetrator and I was the victim. DARVO, it's so common that there's an acronym for it.
I think that's really important for people to know. You know, you talk about kind of our entire society coercively controlling women in a way, and how so much of our culture is built around keeping women in these relationships. And one thing that I wanted to add to that I'm seeing more and more is how women's parents often conspire against them with their abusers to keep them in abusive relationships. And this is especially common in very religious areas or very conservative areas. And so it becomes, she's not just trying to escape her husband, but an entire system. And leaving her husband maybe destroys all of her relationships. It's just unbearable what we force so many women needlessly to go through. So we know this is terrible for women. What happens when we bring a child into this mix? Tell me why this whole, well, he might be a bad husband, but he's actually a good father, is just ridiculous.
It's really ridiculous. I have a Substack on this that I wrote a couple of weeks ago, and it's one of my free posts, so anyone can read it. And it's called 10 Reasons Why a Coercively Controlling Father is an Unfit Father. I think that's the title. It might be slightly different than that.
I think
I'm just trying to remember it off the top of my head. But if you go onto my Substack and you have a look for that post, 10 Reasons Why. And it's one of my more recent posts. I think it came out in July of 2024. Have a look at that post, because then I really break it down for you more articulately than I'm probably going to be able to do in the next 2 or 3 minutes here. But just for starters, so the victim survivor is walking on eggshells / landmines all day long. The kids are going to be walking on those same eggshells and landmines, because the kids also know that there's a lot of things that they can't do, that they better not do, because it will cause an explosion in dad. Just as the adult victim survivor knows that, the kids know that too, because the father is, he applies the same entitlement and expectations of control and domination to his relationships with his children as he does to his relationship with his partner, especially if he has this mentality of I'm the head of the household, so I control everyone in the house, wife, children, pets. So the children are also living with really constrained behavior. They're constantly trying to work out, what does dad want from me right now? Does he want me to engage with him and seem to be having fun with him? Or does he want me to shut up, disappear, pretend I don't exist, pretend I have no needs, and basically blend into the wallpaper? A lot of mothers talk about their children becoming very quiet, very withdrawn, having speech delays, because speaking to a perpetrator is so high stakes, and you don't know whether he's going to be happy or furious with what you said. So some children have speech delays where they just don't speak at all, because I'm guessing they're scared to take the risk of saying anything. And perpetrators will also use children to manipulate the situation. So they'll use children to punish the adult victim survivor. If she won't do what he wants, they'll be nasty to the children. He'll also put her in a situation where she feels isolated as a mother and feels like a terrible mother. And he'll do that by criticizing her mothering to the children, making them lose respect for her, making them treat her like dirt and have no respect for her. And he'll encourage and reward them to do that. So he's really damaging their relationship with their one safe parent. He'll often present himself as the goodie. So he'll let the children, for example, not do their homework, not have a bath, not clean their teeth, not have a bedtime, eat as much junk food as they want. As they get older, he might let them, have a lot of freedoms that are dangerous and inappropriate. He's not monitoring whether they're safe or not. But he presents that to them as him being the goodie, the fun one. And then the poor mum is trying to get them to do their homework and clean their teeth and eat a healthy diet and go to bed at a reasonable time so they're not exhausted. And she's the baddie because she's unfun and a killjoy. And that's how he's presenting it to the children. So then she feels like she's a terrible mother, that she can't do anything right, that she's a bad person. She's demoralized. She feels like leaving is impossible because she wouldn't be able to handle the children without him because they're so disrespectful towards her. So some perpetrators, like I say, they appear like the goodie to the children, but what they're doing is actually really nasty and insidious and damaging for the children. Other perpetrators are hostile and mean to their children and make their children feel very frightened to be around them and punish their children very harshly. Some perpetrators do both and swing back and forth between those two modes in a very scary and unpredictable way. And like I say, if you're a child's mother is the most important resource that child is going to have throughout all of their childhood. It's in most relationships, not in absolutely all of them, but in most relationships, it's the mum who is the one who is looking after that child day to day to day, who knows what their favourite things are and what they dislike, who knows, not only their birthdays, but all their friends' birthdays, is the one who is, is doing so much of the work of making that child's childhood a good childhood. And for the father to attack that mother, to break her down, to try and make her feel rubbish and worthless and useless and to blame, is to do a huge, huge, huge disservice to that child. It's so damaging to their child. I would say those are some of the reasons why, no matter, you know, that even if he's not hit the children or not hit the mother in front of the children, he's still an absolutely appalling father. And then let's remember that he'll impoverish the mother, and he'll impoverish her perhaps during the relationship, but also post separation, perhaps by constantly dragging her through the courts. And then he's taking away her ability to provide for the children, and again taking away the ability of the one person on the planet who probably most wants to provide for those children and enable them to get on in life, taking away her ability to do that so selfishly because he wants to keep punishing her and punishing her and punishing her. And thereby he's punishing the children too, and he doesn't care about that. And post-separation, he'll continue his campaign of abuse against the mother very often. Again, just he won't let it go. He won't let her go. And he just keeps doing this to the children's mother throughout their childhood and into their teenage years and into their adulthood as well.
You know, while you're talking about this, I'm thinking of someone I know, like a friend of a friend who I've known since childhood. And this person in childhood was neurodivergent and had like learning disorders and a number of issues. And the mom was a really good advocate for the child, really like working hard to try to get the child on track. And the dad just undermined every effort the mom made. And when they finally got divorced, the dad worked for years and years and years to harm the mother, and especially to align the child against the mother. And so what ended up happening is that this child did get aligned against the mother, moved in with the father, and, you know, you can predict what that looked like. It was a very both permissive and authoritarian environment where, you know, the father didn't really have rules except for when the child was an inconvenience to him and then would become abusive toward the child. And you know, then the child becomes even more aligned to the father. This is a strange dynamic with child abuse where, you know, the child will say, oh, I'd be so much worse if my father wasn't abusing me. And, you know, what ultimately happened is that this child, of course, who had a number of challenges, spiraled and spiraled and spiraled while still, you know, worshiping their father, and ended up in prison and, you know, is an adult now and someone I know. And I was talking to him the other day, and he said, you know, I've really been thinking since I've been in prison, I think that my dad abused my mom and turned me against my mom, and that if that hadn't happened, I might have had a different life. And this is someone in their late 20s, and it's taken them this long to realize, and their mother is now dead. So, you know, there's no healing with the mother. And the damage has been done to the child. And I think that this is perhaps a more extreme case, but I think it's common. I think a lot of people think that if the father is abusing the mother, the children will take the side of the mother. And I do think they tend to when they're smaller and more vulnerable. But I think with older children, dad can become fun dad, and dad can become access to resources, and he'll weaponize that. And I see over and over again with women I counsel where the father has turned the children against the mother, and in so doing also done such immense harm to the children, because he's never turning them against the mother and then providing them a stable environment. He's turning them against her and then providing them with the completely chaotic, unsafe, unhealthy environment because they're not people to him.
Yes, I think this does happen in a number of cases. I think that from my own research, there's a number of factors that feed into how the children react. I think that firstly, how has the father treated the children? Because for children whose father is pretty unrelentingly hostile towards them, there's not much to attract them towards him. It's the children who have a father who's sometimes horrible, but sometimes very permissive and, like we said, fun dad, the goody. I think those children are more vulnerable to that kind of scenario you just outlined. I think also, to what extent is the abuse obvious to the children? You know, is he very obviously abusing the mother in front of the children? If he is, then that tends to make the children more scared of him and less wanting to be around him. if he's not, if the abuse is not that obvious to them, then that tends to make it easier for him to manipulate them in the way you described. I also think, to what extent is it his goal to turn the children against the mother? Because for some perpetrators, that is one of their main goals and they really go for it. For other perpetrators, they don't seem as interested in doing that, for whatever reason in their minds. Some are more interested in doing that than others. So if he's really invested in turning them against the mother, he'll probably have some success with that because he's putting a lot of effort in. But if he's not that interested in doing that, it's less likely to happen. And then finally, to what extent has he broken the mother-child relationship? Some perpetrators, the impact of their abuse on the mother is so bad because they've really succeeded in torturing the mother that the mother can't emotionally connect with the children anymore. Mothers have described it to me as they were in a state where they were just surviving in robotic mode, that their emotions had shut down, that they were kind of dissociated. And also that mothers have described situations to me where they couldn't, they weren't allowed to show their children any love. If they did, they were punished. They weren't allowed to play with them. They were barely allowed to talk to them. And they were not allowed to have any fun with them. And if they tried to have fun with their children, they were punished. Mm-hmm. So in those circumstances, again, the children are very vulnerable to the dad getting them to align with him because they can't connect with their mother. But in circumstances where the children are strongly emotionally connected to their mother, I think that is more protective of the mother-child relationship. But this is never the mother's fault. It just depends on how the horrific abuse of the father is affecting her. But it's never her fault, however it's affecting her, because she's a survivor of something absolutely horrendous. So, yeah, I think in my research, certainly, those factors made a difference as to what direction the mother-child relationship and the father-child relationships took. But that might not apply universally, but that's what I found in the research that I've done. But it's not like I've talked to every person on the planet, so that might not be the case for everyone.
No, I think that's helpful. And again, you know, I appreciate that you say that it's never the mother's fault because, you know, these circumstances are largely out of their control. But I do think that it's helpful for people in these situations to kind of understand what dynamics tend to get which results. So, you know, yeah, for people to know that a strong mother-child bond does matter. Because what I see with a lot of these men is they get really jealous of the bond. So they'll be really opposed, yes, to breastfeeding or to co-sleeping, and they really want to disrupt that bond early. And so I think it's helpful for women to hear, no, you're right, you should cultivate that bond. And not only is that bond natural, but it's protective for you and your child's relationship. So I think that's
absolutely
a good thing to,
yeah,
hear.
If you can, cultivate that bond with everything that you've got, even if you have to do it in secret. You know, I mean, one mother who I spoke with, her abusive partner wouldn't allow her to comfort her child when her child was trying to get to sleep. The child hated going to sleep alone, but he wouldn't allow her to go to the child to like cuddle her to sleep. But what she'd do is she'd wait for him to go to sleep and she'd sneak out of bed and cuddle that child. And, you know, that kept their bond alive. Uh-huh. And he wouldn't let her play with the child when he was at home. But when he left the house, she played with the child. And, you know, she sees those moments where he wasn't there to keep that bond going. And you mentioned that they're really jealous of the bond early on, but also later on. So, for example, a girl who I interviewed for my research, because I've interviewed children as well as mothers, mostly older children, like 10 years old plus. But one girl I interviewed, she was talking about a time when she was about 7 to 11 years old. She said that the perpetrator, whenever she tried to spend time with her mum, whenever she tried to cuddle her mum or watch a movie with her mum, he would come in and disrupt them, and they couldn't do that. And now that they'd separated from him, they were enjoying doing that again. If anyone is listening to this and reflecting on their own circumstances, you know, what is going on there where he's trying to disrupt that bond is really serious, and it could have lifelong impact. So if you can hang on to that bond, you know, really do try. But at the same time, it's a situation that is so difficult because the mothers have been put in a situation of relative powerlessness. So they don't have a lot of options, but at the same time, human beings are really great at looking at situations where they don't have a lot of options and working out how they can work their way around that in the best possible way, and choose the option that's least bad, I guess. All human beings do that. I think when they're confronted with an unreasonable power structure, they look for ways around it. That's little ways, invisible ways. That's something humans can, I think, are universally quite good at.
I also think that's really helpful advice because so many people in these relationships can't leave or can't leave right away, or they have a co-parent who is truly dangerous to the child. I had this horrific story, a friend of a friend who, you know, divorced her abuser, and it seemed like everything was going okay. But he was given visitation with their toddler, and he left the toddler unattended in the bathtub and she drowned. And I tell this story to young women because I want young women to know how serious their relationship choices can be. And I also want people to understand that there are reasons women don't leave. And it's not because they're not smart or they're not thinking or they don't have enough feminism. You know, like you said, people make the choices they can and they kind of hope for the best.
Very often also women are, you know, they know that the structures are against them and they calculate that it might be better to stay while the children are very young, where at least they can protect the children to an extent, rather than ending up in a situation where the children are spending a lot of unsupervised time with a very dangerous father. And so their staying is protective of the children as much as they, you know, that's their understanding of the situation, is that they're staying to protect the child, and they may well be right. You know, that might really be the best decision. It may or it may not. We don't have crystal balls. We can't know how things would have worked out if we made different choices. But yeah, it's that for a lot of women, they're not staying because they're being foolish. They're staying because they've made a very informed, realistic decision, and they're actually far smarter about the risks that their perpetrator poses than the system is. As the story you told at the beginning illustrates, where the court couldn't see how dangerous this guy was. And by the way, that guy in that story at the beginning, where he was talking about killing her, talking about killing himself, saying that he had nothing to lose and blamed her entirely, that is so, so, so dangerous. He is really at the point where he could kill her. So that is so scary, and I'm just infuriated with that court and that judge for not recognizing that.
It's so infuriating, and I am seeing this last week with my readers. This has been kind of the week of readers reaching out to me with their protective order stories, and the circumstances in which these women have been denied protective orders are shocking. You know, X is stockpiling weapons and has, you know, brandished a weapon against her in front of their baby, and she's made out to be the alienator, kind of stuff. So I want to talk about the courts a little bit because, you know, we do still have this idea of children as a resource and as property. And we have this cultural idea that, you know, well, children need a father, and children do need a father if he's a good, decent, involved father. Children need as many loving adults as possible. But it seems that the idea that children need a father has supplanted the idea that children need safety. And we now think it's more important for them to spend time with a father than it is for them to be safe. Can you talk about that and talk about how that has happened and what we can do to counteract that?
So I would say that this whole narrative that it's more important for children to have a father in any circumstances than to be safe is all part of the backlash against women's rights and feminism. And it's a narrative that's been very carefully pushed and pushed by people who you know, supporting the conservative family, the family that is headed by a man, and who are very against divorce because they want men to stay in charge of families. There is no social science basis, there's no research basis that for this claim that it's better for a child to have an abusive father than no father. So what the research shows us is that children do badly in circumstances of parental conflict. And children do very badly in circumstances where one or both of their parents is an abuser. So on the other hand, children thrive in circumstances where there's no conflict, very little conflict, and they're in a peaceful, harmonious home. And if they're in that home with one adult or with two adults or with four adults, if it's harmonious and peaceful, they're going to thrive. It doesn't matter how many adults are in that home, whether it's just the mum, this is the mum and dad and the grandparents or whatever. If it's a harmonious, peaceful home, they're going to thrive. But as soon as you put a child in a situation of conflict where the home is very conflictual, very, very stressful, they're not going to do well. And it's going to be much more of a struggle for them to do well. And as soon as you put the child in a home where there's an abuser, then they're really not going to do well. And we have so much evidence from social science and psychology showing the harm and the damage that abusers do to children when they're in proximity to them. So, yeah, I think that because children whose parents have divorced have been exposed to a lot of conflict, and it's that conflict that's then, you know, then there's been the, you know, parents have tried to find that one or both of the parents have tried to dissolve the conflict by divorcing, then sure, we see that children struggle more afterwards, but it's not because their parents split up, it's because of all the conflict that they were exposed to, and the divorce is just part of the story of, you know, the conflict. The parents didn't want to stay in that conflict, one of them or both of them didn't want to stay in it, so they split up. But it's not the divorce that hurt the children, it's the conflict, because we also see children whose parents stayed married but in a lot of conflict having the same struggles, so it's the conflict. But situations of abuse are more serious than situations of conflict, because abuse is so serious, and we see that children are struggling in multiple domains of their life, you know, whether it's they're educationally, cognitively, emotionally, behaviorally, that they're struggling because they've been exposed to an abuser, and that abuser has chosen to expose the child to their abuse. And let's put that blame on the abuser, never on the victim survivor parent, because the victim survivor parent, as we talked about, never signed up to be abused. They signed up for this good relationship with this person who seemed really nice, and then they got entrapped. So a child who's grown up with an abuser, that is because the abuser chose to be abusive around a child. The abuser could have walked away. They were the one with the power. They could have stopped being abusive. And if they couldn't stop, they could have walked away to protect the child. They never made those choices. They were the ones who made the child grow up with abuse, not the victim survivor parent. But yeah, so I think that that people who are very wanting men to stay the head of the household and to retain power as head of the household have been very successful at putting this idea into our minds that divorce is bad for children, but it's not the divorce. It's the conflict, or even worse, the abuse, not the divorce. Children who have parents who divorce amicably and who parent peacefully and harmoniously as two separate parents, again, we see them thriving.
I think that's really helpful for people to hear, because what I hear from women all the time is that they don't want to break up their family and they don't want to make their child become a child of divorce, because we have convinced women that this is the worst possible thing that they can do. So you talked about the fun dad, and we all kind of know that trope, but there's also kind of like the fun husband who is really nice and romantic sometimes. And I hear from a lot of women, in fact, I would even say like the majority of people who contact me wanting to know if their relationship is abusive, they start their letter with something like, well, my relationship isn't like most of the relationships you talk about because he's nice some of the time or most of the time or usually. And the thing that I always tell them is that the niceness is part of the abuse. So can we talk about the myth that abusive men are never nice?
niceness is integral to keeping you entrapped with the abuser. So it's very unlikely, unless somebody is incredibly unable to leave, again, for like financial reasons or religious reasons or cultural reasons. If people have any choice to leave, then if their abuser is being unrelentingly hostile to them, they're going to take that choice and leave, and they're going to escape or attempt to escape the controller. The controller doesn't want their control to end. They want to keep going with their control. They want to keep exploiting their partner. So they have to be nice sometimes. Again, put nice in inverted quote marks, because otherwise, any woman who had any choice, faced with unrelenting hostility day in, day out, would be leaving. Like I say, unless there was some really major obstacles in her way that were stopping that. So the niceness is absolutely integral. Almost all abusers go through periods of niceness, indulgence, gift giving, romantic gestures, because in order to keep their abuse up and running and to keep being able to control and to keep being able to exploit, whether it's exploiting you sexually, physically through your domestic labor, emotionally through being a sort of emotional, through you know, treating you as though you're his therapist and responsible for all of his problems, just to keep exploiting you, they have to keep you entrapped. And to keep you entrapped, they have to alternate between making you feel rubbish and making you feel special. And they have to make you think that they're still the nice person that they presented themselves to be at the start of the relationship. They have to make you think that the abuse is aberrant and not the norm and is not what the relationship is really like. So yeah, these times of being nice are absolutely to be expected. They're totally predictable. But as you said, they are all part of the abuse. And most abusers cannot keep up being nice for very long, and nor do they want to, because they need to keep you feeling low about yourself, feeling unconfident, feeling like you're to blame, that it's your fault. They need to keep you feeling scared and nervous and apprehensive of how they're going to react if you disobey them. So the niceness cannot be all the time, because then you start to relax and assert yourself again and start to behave like a human being wants to behave, you know, that you have rights and that you're an individual and you want to pursue your dreams. So they have to keep all that squashed down. So they can't be nice for long, but they have to be nice sometimes. Otherwise, unless there's something really in the way, you would leave them. So yeah, it's all part of the abuse.
Well, I think that's really helpful, and it's what people need to hear. So my last question for you is, this podcast, I'm trying something new that if listeners like, we may keep doing, which is that, as you all know, I do an advice column, and I thought it would be interesting to pose an advice question to our guest about something that she's an expert on. So I asked readers what they would like to ask you about, and here was a question that I thought was compelling. So Emma and I are going to talk about this question, and we'll see what she thinks. Here it is. My husband has been sexually abusive to me, along with emotional and financial abuse. He's an authoritarian father who has never hit our children, but who has engaged in a wide range of emotional and psychological violence. I hate him. I can see how my kids are growing to hate him, too. I want to leave, but I know he may get 50-50 custody and will almost certainly get some custody because the courts do not care about children and women beyond treating them like property. I hate my life with him. I hate that I cannot provide my children a stable home. I am terrified of what will happen to them alone with him, but I know that I would at least be able to provide stability at my house if I got him out. Is it better for them to stay? Better for him to stay and to expose them to his constant abuse? Or is it better for me to leave and expose them to part-time abuse but with no protection from me?
That's really heavy. And I know it's a situation that so many mothers are in.
It's tough.
So yeah, I mean, it's so tough.
I think maybe start with a risk assessment. I think with really young children, where there's a situation where he might endanger their life, leaving them in the bathtub, giving them an allergen, I think then we might have to lean more towards staying. I think with older children, then we have to look at factors like, you know, what are the dangers that they would face alone with him? And are those dangers offset by having stability at home? Because I don't know. I mean, I think there's great value in having at least part-time stability, don't you think?
I do think. And again, from the women and the children who I've interviewed with for my research, in some circumstances, the children were doing really well when they were having to see their father sometime, but the stable and loving and calm and safe home that their mother was providing was doing them a lot of good. I think how much custody is an important point, because I think 50-50 is an awful lot of time for children to spend with an abusive father alone. But if it was less than that, if it was more infrequent, then it would be more worth it, and it would be more manageable for them.
Yeah, the 50-50 that's tough. And I get up on my soapbox about this a little bit. One of the things that I tell women is don't take legal advice from someone who's trying to hurt you. You know, the fact that he tells you he's going to take the kids or that he's going to get 50-50 custody doesn't necessarily mean that he can. And the fact that, you know, somebody in a support group you're in had this happen to them in a different state or country doesn't mean it's what's going to happen to you. You know, we have lots of different
legal. I was just going to say that. Yeah.
Lots of different legal systems.
Yes. And one thing you often say in Liberating Motherhood is that speak to local lawyers, because it varies by state, and know, you know, the lawyers know what the judges in your area are like. So, yeah, I think that's really important advice. One thing I want to do is read you some quotes from mums and children who were living apart from perpetrators.
Oh, yeah, that's great.
And in some cases, the children were still occasionally seeing the perpetrator, but it wasn't 50-50, because I think 50-50 is really hard for the children. But in some of these cases, they were still occasionally seeing him, but they were mostly living in the safe and calm home with their mum. So this mum, she's talking about her teenage son, and his name is John. These are not real names, but these are the names I used in my book, Coercive Control in Children's and Mothers' Lives, and I'm drawing the quotes from my book. So the mum says, John, her teenage son, he was painting the bathroom. He never would have done that before. His dad wouldn't allow it. And he dropped the paint, and he thought I was going to go mad, because his dad would have gone mad. So I come along and he says, you're probably not going to ask me to paint anymore, are you? And I said, don't worry, John, I will. Things like that that his dad would never have allowed him to do. And then John said to me the other day, Mum, will you teach me how to make pastry? Because he wants to learn. And again, he never would have dared to ask that when his dad was around, because he would have been mocked for it, or he would have been criticized if it had gone wrong. It never could have happened before. But now these new horizons and opportunities were opening up. And another quote I want to read for you is, where the mum says about her and the children and the life that they have together, and her children were occasionally seeing the father. She said, we just support each other. We support each other, her and her daughters, through cuddles and cups of tea and chocolate. We put on a film and snuggle up together. We know we're going to be there for each other, and we do help each other, and we just know that we love each other. And they had this really nice relationship now, and it taken years to get to that point. When she first, that particular mum who we just heard from just then, she said when she'd first separated from her abuser, her kids were quite young, and he was one of those abusers who sometimes was really nice to the kids and sometimes was really scary with them, and they hated her for taking them away from him. And they were really angry with her for about 2 years. But when I interviewed them, it was several years later, and they developed these really warm, loving relationships with their mother over time. And she was just able to stick out the initial hating and just hang in there and be a good mother to them. And they eventually they really adored her by the time that I interviewed with them. I've rarely heard teenagers who adored their mum so much as those girls did. And another mother said about her little son, she said, "I feel like now I can show him how much I love him and how fun and interesting he is and take an interest in him without worrying that his dad will stop me. We play lots of games together now. I've taught myself to play with him." And she described how even if she could have played with him before, like she wouldn't have been physically stopped before, she said she was so ground down by it all that she didn't have the mental ability to play with her son when she was being coercively controlled, because she said, "I was so ground down." She said, "I was like this sad little woman trapped in a house." It was just not possible for her. But now that she was free and she had a lot of time, you know, with her son, just the two of them, as she said, she taught herself to play with him. She taught herself to show an interest in him. And she said with a lot of pride that he was now giving her feedback like, "You're a great mum. And I'm really lucky to have you as my mum." And these were things he'd never said to her before. And that was meaning a lot to her. And the children who I spoke to in these sorts of circumstances where things were good with their mums, they said things about their mum like, "She's always there and she's kind and she helps me. My mum makes everything better. She's always there for me. She would do everything in her power to help me." And one teenage boy said, "Mum's the parent I can rely on." So like I say, these kids, some of them, they were still seeing their father, albeit not particularly often, but they and their mums had got these really lovely relationships now. Not in all cases, but I want to illustrate what is possible in some circumstances. Having really good, healthy, warm relationships with children post-separation is possible. It really is.
I love that because, you know, there's so much doom and gloom in this world and there's so much fear, rightfully so, because at every level, the system is not biased in favor of protecting children. So mm-hmm. I think people need to hear that there is hope, that there is a path, that you do not have to sacrifice your entire life at the altar of these abusive people. And I would add, in my own surveys of women, the overwhelming majority of mothers got way more than 50-50 custody. Almost all of them, like literally like 99.98%, say that they don't regret leaving, that their lives are better, that their children's lives are better. It can be really hard, and I don't want to discount that, but I think that there's hope on the other side. And I think that people need to know that, you know, there are options and there are resources, not enough resources, but you can be resourceful. You know, if you've lived with an abuser, you've learned a lot to survive day to day, and you can use that to survive your way out.
And absolutely. And it's just reminded me of something that another mother said, that her abuser did a lot of post-separation stalking. And she said that she'd initially worked with a charity to try and establish some, this was like a domestic violence charity, to try and establish some sense of some psychological peace for herself, so he wasn't getting to her constantly. You know, he was driving by her house, he was doing it to upset her. She was trying to work with the charity to get to a point where it wasn't upsetting her the way he wanted it to. And she'd achieved that for a while, and then he'd done something else and it had kind of thrown her off course, and she got really, really upset and felt really bad again. Rightfully, because, you know, it's awful that women have to put up with this and they have to try and train themselves not to feel upset that they, you know, that they're absolutely entitled to feel. But at the same time, they don't want their abusers to still have this power to rule their emotions. And she'd gone back to the charity and she'd done more work and she got back to a place where she felt like she, you know, she had some psychological peace again. She felt more in control as a mother again. And at the point in time where I spoke to her, he was not succeeding with upsetting her despite his stalking tactics, which I should point out, were not terribly severe. I don't think she was scared that he was going to kill her or anything. I mean, if it was more severe, then I can see why you would be terrified about that night and day. But it was more at the level of he was trying to like play these mind games just to keep her upset. And she talked as well about having better mother-child relationships. And she said, like, I'm a lot more chilled out with the kids now, and I can let things go more, and, you know, I can have more fun with them as a mother. Before, she said, I was very sort of tense about everything. And she said, now I have just learned to chill out a lot more with the kids. And she said that was really helping those mother-child relationships. I think that it is possible to get to a place where not everything that he does has the power to hurt you anymore in some circumstances, but it depends how severe what he's doing is. But I think for some people it is definitely possible, and yeah, that's hopeful.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that, and I'm so glad that I got to have you today, Dr. Emma Katz. So I will put links to all of Emma's work in the show notes. She has a great book, she has a great Substack, she's just a mega super genius on these issues, and you should read everything she writes. So if you like the show, I hope you will share, hope you will review, I hope you will comment, and we will be back in 2 weeks.